This is Talk at 12. I'm Katherine Perkins. With gasoline prices hovering around $4 a gallon, a documentary about gas prices couldn't be more timely. Gas Hole is the creation of Scott Roberts and Jeremy Wagner and focuses on the oil industry and the potential of alternative fuels to lessen our dependence on foreign oil. The film is coming to Des Moines this week. Scott and Jeremy have taken it on the road, showing it in cities across the country, followed by a Q&A and discussion about how to impact the situation locally. We'll talk with them about the reaction the film is getting and how making it has changed their lives. Then Extension Market News Director Doug Cooper has agricultural news. It's all coming up on Talk at 12. This is Talk at 12. I'm Katherine Perkins. Just this morning, President Bush spoke of the need to decrease reliance on hydrocarbons as he left for a trip to Europe. President Jimmy Carter sounded the same alarm more than 30 years ago. So why, decades later, are we paying $4 per gallon for gas and more dependent on foreign oil? That's a question my guests sought to answer in their documentary film, Gas Hole, which is coming to Des Moines this week. Scott Roberts and Jeremy Wagner join me now to tell us more about it. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, Great. Thank you. Thank you both so much for being with me today.
Well, thank you for having us.
So there I offered my own summary of the film to start us off, but not having seen it, why don't you give us a little more to go on? What did you set out to do, or what story did you want to tell as you began this project?
Well, what happened was about 2.5 years ago, when gas prices started to, become outrageously expensive. I think there were $2.20 in California at the time.
It's amazing how our perspective changes on what was outrageous, isn't it?
It's amazing, because this was only, 2.5 years ago. And at that point, people started to really talk about, the high gas prices and what it was doing to us. And there was a gentleman who had written a letter to the editor in a newspaper up where Scott lives in Northern California. And this senior citizen had recalled when he was a teenager, he used to race cars. And he had met a man who had invented a water-injected carburetor, and he was getting 100 miles to the gallon on a 1946 Buick Roadmaster.
Let me stop you right there, because we actually have a clip of this man reading a portion of that editorial that we'd like to play from the film. So hold on just a second.
Okay. A man came to the airfield one day with a 1946 Buick Roadmaster. He had invented a carburetor that was water injected and could get close to 100 miles per gallon. He told us that Shell Oil Company had bought the patent from him, which made him a millionaire. Shell told him he could keep the one on this Buick, but could build no more. Now, the Buick Roadmaster was a very heavy car. Can you imagine what that would save on the lightweight cars of today and our energy consumption? Also, the oil industries would have gone broke. My question, whatever happened to this invention? It's been over 55 years, and I'm sure if it was put on the market with today's technology, it could be even more improved. Sincerely, K.R. Cundy, senior citizen.
So you see this editorial in the paper. Did you find out whatever happened to this invention?
Well, we definitely, after seeing it, we didn't know exactly what we wanted to do with it, if we wanted to, make a documentary or make a narrative film, since we come from the narrative world. But after speaking with Ken and doing a lot of research and looking at a lot of documents, we believe that for whatever reason, there's been a lot of technologies over the years that have never come to market, and we think this is one of them.
So Shell bought the patent from this man. I guess if they own it, they can do whatever they want with it, including not doing anything at all. But it seems there are ethical considerations here when you look at the price of gasoline. Why hasn't anyone put pressure on them to use this technology?
Well, that's a good question. And one of the things that that we talk about after the film in our discussions is how come the auto manufacturers are producing vehicles now that get less gas mileage than we did in the 80s. Now, part of that reason is just purely economical, because the price of gas, after our shock in the 70s, we dramatically increased our fuel efficiency. But then gas prices came down and people stopped caring about that particular quality when they were buying a vehicle. And so we have been still increasing our efficiency in the engines. It's just that efficiency is going towards more power and towards bigger vehicles rather than towards better fuel economy. But it's really frustrating for us when, for instance, Chevy is spending millions of dollars to promote, to develop, to bring to market a Chevy Tahoe hybrid, and that hybrid only gets 22 miles to the gallon, which is way less than my 92 Toyota Tercel, and this should have higher, bigger technology. But then what's really frustrating is that the regular Chevy Tahoe gets 20 miles to the gallon. So economically, it just doesn't make sense from a consumer point of view to spend thousands of dollars more for a vehicle that only gets 2 miles to the gallon better. And that there's just such a disconnect between what seems like the obvious thing to do in terms of increasing our fuel efficiency and what we're actually seeing on the market.
Have you uncovered other patents, other technology out there that could dramatically increase fuel efficiency that's sitting on a shelf?
Well, actually, we look at three stories of individuals, just guys who were tinkering in their garage. And we look into those stories, and we pick those three because those are the ones that we felt we could substantiate. And it's really shocking when you look at it and realize that, had these inventions been brought to market, how different the world would be today, politically, economically, and socially. And that's one of the things people take away from the film, too, when they leave, is they're just so shocked at what we found. And, one of our big gets, of course, was finding a retired Shell scientist, a research scientist who lives in London, who put together an entire book for Shell, going over, even going back to the 30s, talking about the technology that they had achieved then. And, none of those things are to market now.
And the other thing that we found that was really kind of opened our eyes is when we went to Congress and talked to our Congress members, we were discussing this issue with Representative Sherwood Bullock, who at the time was the chairman of the Science Committee, and he's a Republican. And he told us that the National Academy of Science has identified more than 11 pieces of technology that are currently on the shelf that could be used on our vehicles today to increase fuel efficiency without decreasing the weight of the vehicle. So when you have a Republican telling you that there's technology not being used, it really kind of opens your eyes.
So you take this one story of from this editorial, and you pursue this one story, and did it just lead you down this path? I mean, did you just uncover more and more, or how did it come to make the decision that you wanted to make this documentary, and this was the story you wanted to tell?
Well, we wanted to speak to Ken first, the gentleman who wrote the letter, and he was so credible and had such a great memory. And, when we looked into it, one door opened, two doors, which opened three doors, and we had all of this information. And Jeremy and I decided that, this is something that we need to pursue. I think people would be very interested in hearing these stories. And then, we look at the hidden technologies, and then we go to Washington, D.C., and we try and find out why aren't some of these implemented, and why don't bills get passed that will help that. And then, of course, we decided that we needed to take a look at the history of Standard Oil going back to Rockefeller. And then we look at the solutions of what we can do now. So it really kind of evolved just out of looking at those stories and seeing that, wow, we have something here. And at that time, like we said, $2.20 a gallon, people were outraged. Well, now you can imagine people's reaction to the film.
Well, and I'd like to get some of them involved in the conversation. If you'd like to join in the conversation with filmmakers Scott Roberts and Jeremy Wagner, they're the creators of Gas Hole, this documentary about about foreign oil and alternative fuels and gas prices. 1-866-780-9100 is the number to join in the conversation. That's 1-866-780-9100, or you can email talk@iowapublicradio.org. So were you able to talk to any oil executives about some of this? Were you able to put the question to them? Why haven't we seen this technology being implemented?
Unfortunately, the oil industry categorically denied our request for interviews. They're just not interested. And really, our questions, the way we presented ourselves to them was not, you know, in a Michael Moore way where we're trying to, you know, stand outside their office and make them look like jerks. We really wanted to know. Our questions were even less about this technology and more about what we're doing in the future. How much money are they interested in investing? How quickly do they think that we could make a switch over to all alternative fuels? Which fuels do they think are the most viable? And that's they were not interested in even having those discussions with us.
And I understand they actually laughed at you.
Actually, one of the major oil companies put us on speaker in one of their conference rooms, and they were laughing at us. So,
wow. How did you take that?
I took it like I've taken pretty much everything else that goes along with this movie. Nothing surprises me anymore. When this project started, I would have been the first person to roll my eyes at hearing a story about a 100-mile-per-gallon carburetor. But through the process, it's completely changed the way I feel, and very discouraged, frustrated, but also in the end, very hopeful that there are things that we can do.
Well, I want to talk a little bit. You know, we've been talking about U.S. oil companies, U.S. technology so far. What about foreign interests that control the majority of the world's oil? Did your examination extend outside U.S. borders?
Absolutely. Part of what we were looking at is, you know, again, our goal is really looking at things from the American perspective, but we absolutely, in the 40s and 50s, that's when these, when our oil companies started partnering up with foreign governments, and then that's also the time when foreign governments were starting to nationalize their oil industries because they were starting to see how much money was in it. And that's, I mean, your quote from the earlier today in the news before we came on was about what Saudi Arabia can do to affect the market, and they can do a lot, positive and negatively. And this is a really a big part of our problem is that economically we're so dependent on this one source of energy, and even our biggest, most privately funded company, Exxon, is only, you know, barely cracks the top 10.
We'll come back. We're going to talk about more about that in just a few moments, but we need to take a quick break. My guests are filmmakers Scott Roberts and Jeremy Wagner. We're talking about their film Gas Hole, which can be seen at the Fleur Cinema and Cafe this Wednesday in Des Moines. This is Talk at 12 from Iowa Public Radio News. This is Talk at 12. I'm Katherine Perkins. My guests are filmmakers Scott Roberts and Jeremy Wagner. We're talking about their documentary Gas Hole, which examines the reasons behind high oil prices and the prospects for alternative fuels. We invite you to join in the conversation about what the filmmakers found in their investigations and what can be done to lessen U.S. dependence on foreign oil by calling 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100 or email talk@iowapublicradio.org. Well, as we went to the break, we were talking a little bit about extending this conversation beyond U.S. borders and looking at how our reliance on these foreign sources of oil impacts our national interest. Do you want to continue what you were saying?
Well, yeah. Part of our greater problem, this is what we're seeing right now, is when that price jumps up dramatically, there's very little that we can do to affect it. You know, we have to go to another country and essentially ask them very nicely to please increase their production, and that seems to be the only solution in the short term that anyone has for us. And this is really what we have to think about long term, is that right now when you spend $3 on petroleum, you can't even buy a whole gallon of gasoline, but two of those dollars immediately leave the country. And that's it's so detrimental to the United States, because then it's only $1 that's left in your local economy to come back around through the system to pay you for whatever it is you do for your job. So you have to work three times as hard or three times as long to make $3 to buy another $3 worth of petroleum to send two of those $3 out of the country. And what we really have to do is come up with and pursue alternative fuels that can be produced locally. So that way, when you're spending $3 on your fuel, those $3 go to your neighbor. They go to the farmer, they go to your local biodiesel or ethanol refinery, and then that money stays in your local economy, and then those $3 come back to you. But that's what we're seeing right now. Is the other part of that is then if that energy is being produced locally, we don't care necessarily what's happening in Saudi Arabia because it doesn't affect the farmer down the street.
Let's talk with Bill in Cedar Rapids now. Hi there, Bill.
Hello.
Go ahead with your comments.
Yeah, I have a question. I appreciate what you're doing. I can't wait to see the film. But I've heard some rumblings online in some of the blogs and in some other talk radios, more on the conservative end of the talk radio, but that a lot of people are chalking up these claims of 100 miles a gallon through the urban legends. And so when I watch the film, why do you guys address this scientifically, if it was actually done, or if it's to prevent people from believing that it's actually an urban legend?
Okay.
Yeah, what we've done is, Scott and I aren't engineers and we're not mechanics, so what we did in the first story is we actually found a patent that we believe to be the patent that Ken Cundy saw. And so we took that to a mechanical engineer, a guy whose job is to help bring patents to market and bring ideas to market just to see if it was feasible, if it could work. And then we tried to find as much other substantiating evidence about, okay, well, if this is the patent we thought it was, how would this guy living in Northern California in the 40s, how would he have gotten to Shell? And so we tried to make the picture as complete as possible in all aspects of it. And we have three stories about different pieces of technology that we felt like we could. We talked to a person who was an eyewitness, and we found documentation to support what they were saying. And now it's up to you as the viewer to decide whether or not that case has been presented fully or not. But the other part of this is that those stories are only a small part of the film and a small part of the equation. Whether or not it's 100 miles to gallon or if it's 60 miles to the gallon, we can do much, much better than we're doing now. And if we were just getting 60 miles to the gallon, we would dramatically be decreasing our dependency.
So what do we need to do to get there? This is obviously a policy issue from the U.S. Our economy is so reliant on energy. And you point out the dichotomy. President Carter warning about this 30 years ago. And then, back to back with a clip of President Bush issuing almost the same warning today. Why hasn't anything been done?
Well, interestingly enough, it even goes back to President Nixon, who was saying the exact same thing.
And, the issue is it's an economic issue, is a big part of it. We talk about the Shell buying up this patent in the 40s. Well, in the 40s, energy dependency wasn't a problem. And it was just a good business decision. It wasn't this evil thing that happened. But these policies that were good business decisions 40, 50 years ago they're no longer good for the country. And part of the problem is that these companies are no longer even American companies. When two-thirds of their investments are in another country, it's no longer an American company.
And another issue is, what we found out doing this film, which was so shocking, is when you have a committee in Washington, D.C. put together that is supposed to police the industry and look out for the consumer, and you realize that the two chairmen of the committee has taken the most money from oil and gas of anyone in Washington, D.C. I mean, it's pretty hard to get anything done when you're stacked against those odds. And, you know, even the oil executives, on when they were in front of the committee, said that they work very closely with the auto manufacturers on their engine design, which, you know, common sense is, if I'm selling gasoline and I'm helping you develop your engines, why would I want you to develop an engine that uses less of my product?
Absolutely.
It doesn't make sense.
Let's talk with Tom in Kyoto now. Hi there, Tom.
Hi. The problem that we're seeing, the reason why nothing's been done, is because, by and large, people don't care. People care enough to go out and buy that Tahoe that gets 2 extra miles per gallon, but they don't care enough to actually go out and get something that makes a real difference. It just drive home and count how many people you see in massive SUVs, and there's one person driving it, and there's nobody else. And it's not like people are bad. People have... their basements are flooded, and their kids are sick, and they've got a jerk of a boss they have to worry about every day. So when they're presented with the rest of these problems, they see a commercial on TV that they dream of taking their SUV off-roading someday, and in reality, all they do is drive through stoplights with one person in a massive SUV, and people just don't care enough to, and that's the problem that people who do care have, is making people care enough about something like this.
Okay. Tom, thanks very much.
Yeah, Tom, actually, we part of what we did, because this is an important part of the equation, is we talked to a psychologist to see, you know, to ask him these questions, what are part of our problems as consumers that we haven't embraced and demanded better fuel economy in our vehicles, and that's a large portion of it. I mean, we were getting better fuel economy, and gas prices went down, and people just, they didn't have to care about it anymore, and it wasn't affecting them in the pocketbook. So that's exactly what happened. But there's another part of that too, is that, you know, when you're that the psychologist told us, is when you go to buy a vehicle, if you're buying a vehicle because it's going to, you know, help the environment, that's this concept that's about buying a vehicle to help everyone and help the world, and it's sort of intangible. Whereas if it's bigger or faster or has a better CD player or looks cooler, that's something that's an immediate gratification. And so it's hard for people, for a lot of people, to buy something that doesn't have this immediate sense of reward. It's just a difficult problem in America. We don't think about the buying, doing things for other people. It's about the individual.
And it's true. That's a great point, because, you know, people are hurting. People are working two jobs. People are worried about paying and affording health insurance. They're worried about education for their kids. You know, there's a lot on people's plates. And when you look at this issue, it does seem overwhelming, and a lot of people feel helpless.
We're going to come back. We're going to talk more about this, and I want to hear who you talk to, who's involved in the alternative fuels movement, and what developments are out there. We're talking with filmmakers Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts about their documentary Gas Hole, coming to Des Moines Flora Cinema this Wednesday. We'll return to the conversation after a break. This is Talk at 12 from Iowa Public Radio News. You're listening to Talk at 12. I'm Catherine Perkins. We're talking about Gas Hole, a documentary coming to Des Moines this week with filmmakers Jeremy Wagner and Scott Roberts. We've been talking about the process of making the film and what they discovered during that process. You can join in the conversation by calling 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email talk@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go right back to the phones. We have Carol on the line from Marion. Hello, Carol.
Hi, Catherine, and hi to Scott and Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi. I'm calling, I guess I have a comment in response to the previous caller. I think the apathy has stopped. I think that perhaps the $2.20 gasoline price created that apathy, but now I'm seeing a lot of middle income and above people very concerned and definitely changing their travel plans. And so I do believe that you were going to get a lot more reaction. I'm very interested in seeing the film and hoping that it's going to be shown here in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area. And after it's showing throughout the nation, do Scott and Jeremy have any plans for having this film distributed through the internet media?
Okay, Carol, thanks. Good questions.
Yeah. What we're doing is Scott and I are personally taking the film on a 43-city tour. We're going to be in Des Moines on Wednesday for one showing only, and then after that we're on to St. Louis. If you're interested in following us, seeing where we're at, seeing where we're going, and seeing when we're going to be in a wider release, we have a website, which is gasholemovie.com. And then what our plan is at the end of this tour in the fall, is we're going to release the film in all the major markets theatrically, and then it will be available on DVD after that. And you will be able to, again, follow us on that website, gasholemovie.com, to see when the DVD release is going to be and also when we're going to be released in theaters.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about what you found in terms of how we can move forward and escape these high gas prices. And you did an examination of the alternative fuels industry. What did you find?
We found a number of encouraging things. Now, you know, it's only one movie, so we only really focused on a couple of pieces of technology that people are implementing now, and they were the ones that were actually most surprising to us. We look at biodiesel to a degree because it was fascinating to us, and this is something that we just didn't know, is that the diesel engine, when Rudolf Diesel invented it and presented it at the World's Fair at the turn of the 20th century, he presented it using peanut oil. So the diesel engine, when it was created to run on a vegetable oil, and what that means is that that engine is an alternative fuel engine. It's just something that has been lost over time, but now people are starting to realize. And so we talked to people who are actually starting to offer B99, which is essentially 100% biodiesel, because you can use that in a diesel engine without making any conversions. You can put biodiesel in it one day and then regular diesel in it the next. And this was exciting to us because if we could put biodiesel in all of our truck stops up and down the freeway and have our transportation industry start using, even if it was 20% biodiesel in a blend, that would immediately start to improve our self-dependence and to encourage that market, and nobody has to buy a new vehicle at all. So it's encouraging that there are ideas, and we tried to look at as many different ideas as possible that could be started to be implemented immediately, not 10 years, not 20 years, not 30 years down the road, and that don't involve people having to change, go buy a $40,000, hybrid today.
But we're also hearing arguments now being raised about the competition between food and fuel and using some of these crops for fuel and diverting them from their use as food. Did you do much thinking about that?
Part of our issue with the rising food prices right now is really less a factor of how much corn we're using for ethanol and much more about the fact that your food is transported using petroleum, and that petroleum cost has doubled. But it is absolutely part of the equation, is developing feedstocks that can be grown in an area that doesn't take away from our current agricultural production. But there's a lot of things to this equation. Right now, we're still paying our farmer subsidies not to grow. So we have to eliminate those subsidies, since now there's a market for American agriculture. And then in addition to that, there are a lot of ideas. There's one idea that's being tested about making biodiesel from a blue-green algae, which can be grown using salt water, or it can be grown using gray water so it doesn't impact our water supply. It also can be grown in land that's not suitable for regular agriculture. And you can replace, there's a man named Michael Briggs who did a report. He's a professor from the University of New Hampshire. So he did a study to see how feasible this idea is. And could grow enough biodiesel from blue-green algae, grow it in about one-third of the Sonora Desert in California to completely replace our petroleum use in the United States. And the cost he came up with is less than we've spent in the Iraq War.
Let's talk with Peter in Iowa City next. Hello, Peter.
Yes, indeed.
Go ahead.
Okay. Okay. Now, I am guessing talked about a Buick Roadmaster getting 100 miles per gallon. That would represent something like a 4 or 5-fold improvement. I would be surprised if a big car that day got 20 miles per gallon, but suppose it did. It'd be a 4 or 5-fold improvement.
Currently, you're getting out of your petroleum use, you're getting about 18 to 20% used to move your vehicle. So
By the 1950s, I happen to know some figures. Okay, they had gasoline engines that used in aircraft by the 1950s that were getting measured results of like 30% thermal efficiency. So there would not seem to be, I mean, the most thermal efficiency you could possibly have is 100%, and it would seem like you could just, there's not room for that much. Plus, I mean, because you're talking about things that the heat being thrown away in the exhaust, people, you know, so on. But in other words, it just doesn't seem like there's that much room for improvement.
Skeptical about these claims, Peter?
Especially, I mean, that one, because I've seen the same stories going back to 1940 with very, very similar claims, although they didn't mention water ejection, but it was a carburetor.
Okay. Peter, thanks. Any response to Peter's skepticism?
Absolutely. again, what our goal in looking into these stories was to see whether or not they seem feasible, whether or not we found information to corroborate the stories. We presented as much information as we could to support them. And whether you believe that vehicle was getting 100 miles a gallon or whether you can accept that it was getting substantially better than the gas mileage at the time, the idea still for us is that you can do much better than we're doing now. So whether it's 100 miles a gallon, if that's this magic number that discourages you from moving forward, then throw out that part and maybe you can accept that we can get much better than we're getting now.
And I think, you know, when you come out and see the movie, I think, you know, myself, I was also skeptical when this first started. And when you see what we've put together and what we've compiled and who we've spoken to, I think you're going to be really shocked.
Now, are you surprised by the skepticism? I mean, what has been reaction generally when you've taken the film out and you've shown it to people?
Well, you know, the biggest question at the Q&A sessions after is, you know what, if this technology exists, then why don't the auto manufacturers implement it now? It seems like, you know, that would make the most sense. They would make the most money. You know, that's our question. We would love to have that question answered as well. Unfortunately, none of the auto manufacturers were willing to speak to us.
From a market perspective, it's just so frustrating because we've seen time and time again that even our auto manufacturers can produce better vehicles that get better miles per gallon. Whether or not, again, you buy into a water-injected carburetor idea, you know, these same auto manufacturers producing cars in the United States are selling similar vehicles that get better gas mileage in Europe and in other countries. So it's, again, it's this idea, because gas was cheap, that they could develop a market that was based on SUVs and power and selling all of these things that weren't about fuel efficiency. And now you're really starting to see the impact of that. They put all, kind of all of their eggs in that one basket. And, you know, General Motors is closing a plant in Janesville, Michigan, because people don't want SUVs. And it's just, that demand for SUVs has dropped just in the last year. And now people are starting to lose jobs because we were so short-sighted.
Now, I understand that part of the whole process of taking this to 43 cities and showing it is having these Q&As and then also talking with people about what they can do to impact the situation. What have you been hearing from people about what they're planning?
Well, it's exciting because there are different things happening in different parts of the country. For instance, you know, we've been in the Midwest for the last week, and just driving down the road, there's a lot of stations that are selling E85, whereas in California, there's only three ethanol pumps in the entire state. So in the Midwest, ethanol is more encouraging, and it's something that you can do now, where in California that's not really an option. In fact, they're selling lots of flex fuel vehicles there, but people can't run them on E85, which is, again, a very frustrating part of this equation. But the exciting thing about it is that there are people working and doing things in your local community. And these are the people that are coming to our films and saying, hey, this is what I'm doing. And then the people who are fired up at the end of the movie can start to connect with those people and start to get involved locally. We were in Boise, Idaho, and this is something we didn't know, but there's a guy who's there who's selling for $500 a little conversion kit to run your regular petroleum engine on E85 to turn it into a flex fuel vehicle. So there are things that people are doing, and that's what's really encouraging is when we're in Des Moines talking about what's happening in Des Moines with the people who come to the film.
Let's talk with Lori in Comanche now. Hi there, Lori.
Hi there.
Go ahead with your comments or questions.
First of all, Scott and Jeremy, I think it is, I just wanted to thank you for initiating this film because people are wanting more information and people are wanting to get involved. I just don't think that they have the resources or the connections to actually be able to do something about, you know, what's going on with gas prices. But I guess my biggest, I want to make a comment, the gentleman that had called a couple of phone calls ago about nobody cares. I think that there's probably as many people who do really care and want to do something about it as there is people that don't. And I guess my question is, what kind of tools can you give those of us that do really care and are passionate and wanting to help and do something about this, you know, the contacts and the initiative to go out and actually make a difference and to get this moving forward quickly?
Okay, Lori, thank you.
Well, as we're going around the country, again, this is what our goal is. We're compiling information, and we're meeting people in every city that are trying to do things. You know, people who are fired up and who have been working for the last year or two to try and do things in the local community are the first ones waiting to talk to us after the film. And so the downside is that this project and the tour and everything is essentially just Scott and I. And my wife supporting us a little bit financially, but that's it. So, but we are compiling all of that information, and we're trying to update our website with as much of that as possible. And a big part of it, again, is the people who come to the film. You're going to meet people who are motivated and excited and interested in solving these problems, who are your neighbors. And that's really where this solution has to come from. It has to be a groundswell on a local level, because if we wait for the big companies, the auto manufacturers, and we wait for the oil industry to solve the problem for us, it's never going to get solved. We have to do it ourselves, and we have to demand these changes and look for things that we can do locally.
Did all of this, learning about all of this, cause the two of you to reexamine your own behavior?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when this movie started, I drove a giant pickup truck. And, you know, during the course of it, now I drive an older model Honda Civic that gets about 38, 39 miles per gallon. It's changed the way I read the newspaper. It's changed the way I watch the news. It makes me reevaluate, you know, who I voted for, and it makes me want to look at all the representatives that are running for office, you know, looking where they're getting their funding from. There's a great website called opensecrets.org that lays out what candidate has taken what money from what industry. And, you know, it's made me want to get involved and find out what they're voting on, and I think that's a great thing.
Kind of odd thing about this whole equation is that, you know, Scott and I are both registered Republicans.
I wondered if you saw a party difference in this, and is it a partisan issue, or are both parties equally to blame for this?
Well, you know, it's you know, I've never seen a Republican gas pump, and I've never seen a gas pump that's for Democrats. We're all in the same boat. And we have good Republicans and good Democrats. You know, people on both sides of the aisle that really do want to make a difference and do something, And then, of course, just like in everything, we have those politicians, and we outline a few of them in the film that seem to be, you know, counterproductive on the issue. But
it's really on an individual basis, and that's why it's more important to find out where their funding's coming from. You know, who's interested, if an oil industry is spending a lot of money to support a candidate or to spend against a candidate, then that tells you a lot of things about, apart from just what, who their preacher was.
Okay. Yeah, we definitely, when we started this, we wanted to talk to both sides of the aisle, and we didn't want to alienate anyone or get categorized as left-wing or right-wing, because we thought that would knock out a large portion of the audience.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for taking time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And if I can say, you know, they have the Sex and the City parties going on. If you guys want to get a gas hole party together and come down to the floor, because our success depends on, you know, how many people see the movie, and that will determine how many cities we can release it in September. So come on down to the floor.
Okay.
7 o'clock Wednesday.
Thank you so much. My guests have been filmmakers Scott Roberts and Jeremy Wagner. Their film Gas Hole will have a special screening at the Fleur Cinema and Cafe in Des Moines this Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Now we turn to agricultural news with Extension Market News Director Doug Cooper.
Lots to talk about today with Sam Beatty, Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist. Let's talk flooding, because certainly the spring of 2008, Sam, has caused a lot of excess water in Iowa. If you're not living next to a creek or a stream, your subsoil is fully saturated and water in basements and all kinds of things out there. Is there a food safety concern that we need to talk about?
Sure there is. What we look at is the fact that if any food becomes submerged in water, that it may be a questionable quality. And then the other one is that if your power goes out, which is likely to occur during these situations, you worry about food in your refrigerator and your freezers. What we're encouraging is that people who are consumers who have canned goods that they may be storing in their basement, to move those to a higher shelf so that they don't become submerged in water if your basement does flood.
Even if they're in cans?
Even if they're in cans. The cans are safe. The food in the can is safe, but can become contaminated with anything that's in the water that touches the can. You'll have to go through a sanitation process for the cans. The other thing is that home canned foods we look at, the threads on the jar can become contaminated in an area that is very difficult to sanitize, up underneath the rim of that jar. If you've taken the ring off, that's better. But if you haven't taken the ring off and the jar is water comes up and submerges that part of the can, you'll want to make sure that those threads on that jar are really very clean before you use the contents of that can.
So really, just a lot of common sense comes into play here.
Right. It's common sense, but it's, just because it's in a can doesn't mean you can't contaminate it from the material that's on the surface of the can. I think it's really important.
So what's the best cleaning procedure?
Use a soapy water wash, followed by a light bleach treatment of the can, so you sanitize the can. You're going to lose the label during this process. So that's the hard part, is you're going to lose the label, and you're going to want to be able to take some sort of marker, water indelible, waterproof marker, right on the can top, what's in the can. The idea is that you need to identify the can, when you bought the can or about then, and when you need to use the can by.
What can you use, Sam, to clean the can?
The easiest way to do it is just use soapy water and remove any soil that's on the can, and then come back with a bleach solution that's 1 tablespoon of bleach in 1 gallon of water. And you want to make that unscented bleach, good old Clorox or Hylex is the bleach you want to be using there. The other bleaches may not be as effective or may have some aroma compounds that you don't want in your food in the long run. But good old Hylex will work real well.
Power outages with refrigerators and freezers you mentioned earlier. Is there anything to do other than discard food that's been in a refrigerator or freezer too long?
That's a real tough one.
How do you judge that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. If power goes out in your refrigerator should be at 40 degrees. And if the power has gone out and that refrigerator starts warming up, the perishable foods in there, milks, meats, some vegetables, any leftovers, all that product is going to be subject to that thermal stress, and any bacteria present in those products is going to start growing. So what we're going to encourage you to do is discard that product. If the power does not come on within, 24 hours, you can be pretty well assured that all the perishables in your refrigerator have been thermally abused.
Thermally abused.
They got too warm, and they're potentially they're spoiled. Now, for the freezer, you have a little bit more leeway. They're typically better insulated. After 24 hours, if the power finally comes back on, and you start looking at the food that's in your freezer, and you see large ice crystals, that means that it probably wasn't temperature abused too badly. It may have thawed a little bit, but it still was most likely below 40 degrees, and you could actually refreeze that product. There's going to be some quality loss there, but the safety will have been maintained.
Iowa State University Extension Food Safety Specialist Sam Beatty. For ISU Extension, I'm Doug Cooper.
Our program is produced by Greg Shanley and Jeff Schmidt, with production assistance today from Molly Gallantine. Our engineers are Jim Davies and Nate Schultz in Iowa City, Dick Owen, Steve Peterson, and Dave Knipple in Ames, Phil Moss and Leonard Tompkins in Cedar Falls. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk at 12 are available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. I'm Katherine Perkins. Talk at 12 is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.